This is the second in a three-episode arc of a life story. This episode contains disturbing content. Listener discretion is advised.
In the corner of that cattle car were two buckets of water. Once the water was gone, there were no sanitary facilities. On the third night, we go through a station and we see it lit up. It says Oświęcim. Oświęcim is Polish for Auschwitz. But the train didn't stop. It continued. And a few kilometers later, it stopped. And when it stopped in a place, we see a gate with a sign, and it says, Arbeit macht frei. Labor gives you freedom. And that was Auschwitz.
Ben Lesser's odyssey through the Holocaust had taken him through three countries while he and his family were evading capture by the Nazis. For nearly 5 years, Ben and his family were stripped of their possessions, their livelihood, forced to hide behind walls and under doghouses, made harrowing trips from Poland to Czechoslovakia to Hungary. They watched other families just like them get beaten, shot, and ripped apart by dogs at the hands of the Nazis. They were left with only the clothes on their back, but for 5 years they had at least evaded capture. Until Hitler invaded Hungary. Then, Ben along with hundreds of thousands of other Jews were shipped to concentration camps. In the spring of 1944, Ben was forced to board a cattle car to arguably the most notorious extermination camp in the Nazi system of camps, Auschwitz. I'm Leslie Gold. This is a life's story.
The train only stayed there for a couple hours and then it started to move further. And it moved another, three kilometers and it stopped. It was still nighttime and the gates opened up and all hell broke loose. We hear the Nazis with their dogs screaming, raus, raus, schnell. And we hear people screaming in all languages, come out, come out, come out right now. But leave all of your belongings where it is. Don't you pick up any of your belongings. Women and children to the right, a man to the left. And I'm holding on to my sister Goldie, my little brother Tuli, and they were just pulled away from me, never to see again.
Ben's little brother and little sister were sent directly to the gas chamber.
They both went to the gas chambers. Of course, I didn't know that. We didn't know where we are. We didn't know about gas chambers. But I went with my uncle and my cousin. Why? Because I figured I was 15 and a half years old. I could have gone with the children or with the adults, but I figured if you're an adult, they'll put us to work, and if we work, they're gonna feed us better. But I had no idea about dying or killing or anything like that. And it was still dark, and we see those chimneys with flames shooting out of them. About five chimneys and ashes are flying all over. So the men in front of us were saying, oh, those places must be places where they must be smelting factories, probably where we will be working. Who knew? Who had an idea? We didn't know what those ashes were, that those ashes were our family, our loved ones, the ashes they were burning. We don't know. I see this man with a white frock, just like a doctor. He had white gloves. He goes with his index finger, right, left, right, left, right, left. And every once in a while, he would ask a question, talk to somebody. There was a young man, maybe in his early 20s, that he's asking, can you run 5 kilometers? Or would you rather go by truck? And he said, oh, he had the knee problem. He would rather go by truck. Poor soul, not realizing that meant certain death. They sent him to the right. But me, I was 15 and a half, and something didn't sound right to me. I said, why would he ask such a question? Obviously, we're here. I can see barracks. We're in a camp already, and factories. Why would he ask that? So I figured he is asking that question to see if you're strong enough to work. So I tell my uncle, since I spoke German, I tell my uncle and my cousin behind me, I said, let me go first. But remember, whatever he asks you, tell him, yes, you can run. Yes, you're healthy. You'll work. And before he asked me a question, I saluted him. I stretched myself out and I said, 18 Jahre alt, gesund und arbeitsfähig. I'm 18 years old, I'm healthy and I can work. So he asked me, Konstantin, can you run 5 kilometers? I said, jawohl, yes. And he sent me to the left.
Like so many instances before this, that proved to be a fateful decision. Ben's instincts to say he was 18, an adult age, and he could run and he could work, spared him, for the moment, from going directly to the gas chambers. Ben's uncle and cousin followed his lead. All were sent to the left.
And they ordered us all to get undressed, get out of your clothes and your shoes, leave everything there on the floor, and walk over to the line of barbers. They're going to cut your hair, and from there you're going to go to the showers.
Take off your clothes and your shoes. Your shoes. Remember, Ben's uncle had given him shoes with diamonds hidden in the heels in case the worst ever happened.
My uncle, who gave me those shoes, and his son, who also was those shoes, they got out of the shoes, but I decided to keep my shoes on, and I walk over to the line of barbers, a bunch of inmates with their clippers, and they cut my hair. They were not exactly gentle the way they cut it either, but as they're cutting my hair, I'm still wearing my beautiful black shoes. No one is saying a word. And then they sent me to go into the bathhouse, a big room, and spigots on top of the ceiling. When they closed the door in that room, some people started to scream. And I didn't know why they screamed. I guess some people knew that the gas chambers looked like showers, but instead of water, gas would come out. But when the water started to come out from those spigots, it got quiet. They give us a number with a tag. My number was 41212. That was my name from that point on. We are told, don't you ever leave that, that number has to be on you all the time.
Thus began the dehumanization process. Each prisoner of the concentration camps was stripped of everything they had ever known, leaving them feeling worthless. All captives who were allowed to remain alive temporarily in the death camps were stripped of any human individuality. Shaved heads, identical uniforms, no names, literally just a number from this point on. The Nazis did not think of Jews as human, so they were not provided with what a human needs to stay healthy or even just to survive. The victims in the camps were overworked, not given enough rest time or enough food, which resulted in malnourishment, exhaustion, dysentery, and other disease, and eventually death by exhaustion.
They also gave me shoes. They were wooden shoes, wooden soles, but they had a canvas on top. I got into those shoes and I took my black shoes and I put them under my arm behind my jacket. The Stubenälteste, the man in charge of the barrack, he was an inmate. He comes out and he counted us. And then he tells us in a broken German, he says, "Ha, you Hungarian Jews, you think you're here on vacation? Think again. You see those chimneys, those ashes, those flames? Those are your mothers, your fathers, your brothers, and your sisters. And if you don't behave and do exactly what you're told, this is how you're going to wind up, ashes."
Life in the camps was brutal but straightforward. Work until death.
This is the 20th century. These are cultured people. They're burning all the people, the ashes, my brother, my sister, ashes. He's pulling out of legs.
The thought of a deliberate, systematic, and mass extermination of people was beyond comprehension for anyone with an ounce of humanity in them. Literally unbelievable, even to those who were within eyeshot of it, and those to be victims of it. Ben, his uncle and cousin, pick top bunks in the barracks and immediately fall asleep from pure exhaustion.
About a half hour or an hour later, my cousin wakes me up. He hits me. He says, Ben, get up. I said, whoa, what's going on? He says, listen. And I hear a chanting, a crying, or a singing or praying. We couldn't figure out what it was. And then he says, look, one side of the barrack had some boards missing from the wall, and we can see an orange hue, a big orange hue. And he says, what is that? I says, I don't know. I knew that the Stubenälteste, the man in charge of the barrack, was Polish, and I spoke Polish. So I walked, and I came with the Hungarian Jews, so don't worry. I walked over to him, and I say in Polish to him, excuse me, can you tell me what I hear and what I see? He was so happy to see someone speaking his language. He couldn't stop talking. He was telling me all the things that's happening in Auschwitz. He says, what you see are flames, and what you see, there are people being burned in there. You Hungarian Jews, you know nothing. 6 months before the Nazis ever occupied Hungary, they made us dig ditches for the influx of the Hungarian Jews. So now you know why Hungary was occupied.
In episode one of Ben's story, we included a little history lesson about a meeting where Hitler met with the dictator of Hungary, Horthy, and demanded Hungary's Jews. Horthy did not want to comply. Shortly after, Hungary, a member of the Axis and an ally of Germany in the war, was invaded by Germany.
6 months before they even occupied Hungary, those ditches were for Hungarian Jews because they knew that the trains with inmates, with people would come in so fast and furious that they wouldn't have time to go through regular channels.
Regular channels, so to speak, in a Nazi concentration camp meant gassing large numbers of Jews, then moving the dead or near dead bodies into the crematoriums to turn the bodies into ashes. Gassing and burning takes time. Too much time for the taste of the Nazis when hundreds of thousands of Hungarian Jews were being shipped in cattle car after cattle car.
So now they watched through the window, and if they saw the people were all laying on the ground quietly, they had the doors opened and they had to air it out for 15 minutes. And then the Sonderkommando, the man in charge, they were inmates. This was their job, had to pull out the bodies, pull out their gold teeth, cut their hair, and then put them on gurneys, four or five people with a rope on it, and take them to the crematorium. But they didn't have enough time for that either. So now they had dump trucks. They were dumping these half-dead bodies on these dump trucks and taking him to the fire pits. I said, well, what about that sound I hear? He says, Jechi, children, they didn't have time for children. They wouldn't even take the children into the gas chamber. Infants, they would simply have them wait outside. And then they threw him on top of these dead bodies in these trucks, and they would take him to these trucks and dump him into these fiery pits.
Children, awake and breathing, were burned alive.
I remember as a kid, my dad waking up and having nightmares and screaming.
That's Ben's daughter, Gail. Gail had not heard these stories from her father as a child. She hadn't heard them until she was well an adult. But today, Gail runs the Zahor Foundation, whose mission it is to ensure the remembrance of the Holocaust.
Before that, I knew my father was a Holocaust survivor. I knew he went to Auschwitz. We would never talk about what went on.
What went on is almost too horrible to believe or to convey in simple words. But as terrifying as it had been fleeing from the Nazis, nothing compared to the agonizing hell on earth of a Nazi death camp. In Auschwitz, those that were allowed to live another day were fed bread that was made with sawdust instead of flour, and soup that was just water with garbage thrown in it. Sometimes a rat. The prisoners were being starved to death as they were worked to death. Any infraction, even a small one like removing your hat a split second too slowly in front of a German soldier, meant you got shot. Every morning in the barracks, the Jews that were alive would stand for selection. If the Nazis looked at you and decided you looked too weak to work, you were sent off to the gas chamber. Every morning, selection.
Anyway, after 2 weeks, they put us in trucks. And then they took us on a ride with these trucks, and we arrived at a camp called Dernau.
Dernau was a rock quarry where boulders were unearthed, moved, and pulverized into gravel.
What the work was, as we went to work, as they dynamited the mountain and boulders were coming up, down, it was our job with sledgehammers to break it up into smaller, manageable pieces, throw it into mining carts, run down the mining carts to the bottom where they had a grinding machine, and they ground it into gravel, and then push those carts back up and pound away on these rocks. It was backbreaking work, and I knew that my uncle is not going to survive that. So I went to the chef from the kitchen and I bribed him with my diamonds from my shoes to give my uncle a job in the kitchen.
You still had your diamonds.
I still had my diamonds. Now, my uncle didn't have it anymore, and my cousin, they went out of it. But I had my diamonds. So I offered them diamonds to give my uncle a job in the kitchen. And he accepted, gave my uncle a job in the kitchen, and he took my diamonds. he took a few, but then whatever I had, and more, he wanted more. And when I had none of them left, he still let my uncle work there. Now, in the kitchen was easier work, and they can eat in the kitchen. But when they came out of the kitchen, they couldn't take anything in their pockets. They were searched. And if they would find any food in their pockets, they would kill them. So now my uncle could share his ration with his son and me because he was eating in the kitchen.
Every day at the end of the brutal workday, the prisoners would be lined up in rows of five, counted, and dismissed.
One day we came home and they line us up in rows of five and they count us. And they count, and they count. And the commandant comes down, and he says, with his Fräulein, his girlfriend, and he says, I'm going to teach the Schweinhund a lesson they'll never forget. What happened? What? Three of the inmates escaped. And because three of the inmates escaped, he ordered to pull out every 10th person in line to receive 25 lashes.
Ben did a quick calculation and realized that his uncle, lined up in front of him, would be the 10th person in the set. Ben swapped places with him.
I was number 10. Then they took us number 10s in the middle of the yard. They brought down a horseshoe. I don't know if you know what. I'll show you a picture of it. Two horseshoes, you put a log of wood to cut.
Oh, sawhorse.
Sawhorse. They brought on the sawhorse, and they bring down bundles of hard wood, like 1 inch by 1 inch, maybe 2 feet, 2-3 feet long. And this is what they order us to do. Tiptoe. Put your knee inside the opening of the sawhorse. Bend over. One man would pull your trousers like real tight, like a drum. And the other one was hitting you with those stakes. And you had to count out loud. If you miscounted, you have to start from one again. If your heels touch the ground, you start from one again. If your stomach touches the 2x4 of that sawhorse, start from one again. There were three men ahead of me. The first one goes up, and every time they hit him, you can see a line of blood coming right through the trousers. And he yells out, eins, zwei, drei, vier. Then he miscounted, and his feet touched the ground. His stomach touches the 2x4. Start again and again. Finally, he collapsed. When he collapsed, the commandant goes over, kicks him in the face. He says, get up. The poor guy couldn't get up. He pulls out the revolver and he shoots him right in his head. When he does that, his Fräulein, his girlfriend, goes over to him and gives him a hug and a kiss like he just performed a heroic act, killed a man. Now number two comes up. Number two, the same way, miscounted. His heel touched the ground, his stomach is touched, and count again from the beginning. Finally, he fell. And the commandant goes over, kicks him in the face, get up. He couldn't. He pulls out the revolver, shoots him. So we have two dead bodies. I'm number four. Number three goes up. Number three was a little younger. And he also miscounted. And he touched this, he touched that. And they start again and again and again. Then he screamed out, have mercy on me, please don't kill me. Then the commandant says then, stand up and come walk over to me, face me. The poor guy stands up, makes about four or five steps, and his knees gave out from under him. He falls. The minute he falls, the commandant goes over, kills him. So I have three bodies, and I am next in line. I was the youngest from all of them. I remember walking up to that sawhorse, bending over, and I talked to myself. I said, Ben, this is it. If you want to survive this, you want to live another half hour, you have to do exactly what you're told. I walk over, I tiptoe, I bend over the sawhorse without touching the 2x4. One man is pulling my trousers and the other one starts to hit. And I am counting. Eins, zwei, drei, vier, fünf, sechs, sieben. Finally, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 25, I made it. You could hear a pin drop in that camp because no one believed that anyone could survive this. And when I made it, the man who was holding my trousers real tight says to me in Yiddish, he says, walk over and thank him. And I stand up and I walk over, blood is running down my trousers. I walk over to him, I salute, and I said, Danke schön, Herr Kommandant. Thank you very much, Herr Kommandant. When he hears that, he puts his hand on my collar. And I wonder why. What is he going to kill me now for surviving this? He twists me around facing the number 10s who are still to be beaten. He says, now I told you it could be done. If you do it like this, Junge, you have nothing to worry about. So he made an example out of me.
For weeks, Ben could not lie on his back because of the welts from the beating. Decades later, Ben's children saw the scars on his back, but not knowing the details of Ben's hideous experience with the Nazis, they just drew their own conclusions. His daughter, Gail.
I remember as a kid seeing the scars on his back. And they weren't so severe. They were pretty much healed. But I thought that they were, he drove a UPS truck. I was a little kid. I thought that they were just kind of marks from his truck.
And while this is going on, there is a commotion at the gate. They caught those three inmates. They were pulling them in. You couldn't recognize any of them, bloody, beaten to pieces. And they're pulling them in the gate. And when the commandant saw that, just like a child who gets sick of a toy and he pushes the toy away, he told us, all of us number 10, to go back in our line. And he orders his henchmen to bring down a portable gallows. They brought down a single gallows, and we all had to watch while they were hanging these three men one by one. I remember the last one was younger, and he was religious, I guess. He cried out a prayer, Shema Yisrael. This prayer is said before dying. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Shem Eloheinu. Two more words, because it's only six words. When they heard it, they kicked the stool out from under him, and they wouldn't let him complete Adonai Echad, the last two words, God is one. They were such sadists. One night, we hear cannon fire, like the front was closing in. That morning, we report to go to work. As we came down to go to work, we hear a loudspeaker saying, no one is going to work today. The camp is being evacuated.
It was February 1945. The Allies were advancing aggressively and squeezing Nazi Germany in a metaphorical vice grip. In the West, Hitler's desperate counteroffensive against the Allies in Belgium's Ardennes Forest had ended in total failure. In the East, the Soviet army had captured East Prussia and reached within 50 miles of Berlin. The once proud Luftwaffe, German Air Force, was a skeleton of an air fleet, and the Allies ruled the skies over Europe, dropping thousands of tons of bombs on Germany every day. The Nazis began a feverish evacuation of the work camps and death camps. Hundreds of thousands of prisoners were evacuated from hundreds of concentration camps, incarceration, and labor facilities along the retreat paths of the collapsing Third Reich. According to Nazi records, roughly 714,000 prisoners were languishing in the concentration camp network in January of 1945. This final phase of the war was viciously murderous, even by the horrifying standards of Nazi genocide. As American forces approach, the Germans continued frantically moving prisoners out of the camps. Almost 30,000 prisoners are forced on death marches away from the advancing American forces. About a third of these prisoners die during the marches.
My uncle was already in the kitchen. We couldn't say goodbye to him. And they marched us out. That was called a death march. Because if you could not keep up pace with the soldiers, they simply shot you. And all day long, you heard pop, pop, pop being shot. 1 week, 2 weeks. And after about 2 weeks, my cousin got very weak. He says, "Ben, let me sit down at the snow. Everyone will pass. They'll shoot me. I can't take it anymore." I says, "No, Isaac, it's not going to happen. We will both survive this. I will help you." And I helped him along walking. I pulled him along. We had to march at a certain pace, the same pace as the soldier. And it was snow on the ground. His shoe fell apart already. He is walking barefooted. And then a couple days later, my shoe fell apart. And I'm walking barefooted on snow. Now, we lost time. I don't remember if it was 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks. But I found out lately that it was 7 weeks that we marched from Dernau to Buchenwald. Is about 450 kilometers. And we marched there, arrived in Buchenwald. We were still alive. And when we came in, they lined us up and counted us. And they told us to go into this barrack. Inside the barrack, they'll feed you. You can shower. They'll give you fresh clothes and fresh shoes. But tomorrow morning, early in the morning, you better come back to this spot at 9 a.m. the whole, because Buchenwald is also being evacuated.
Again, the prisoners are apportioned 80 to a cattle car. Ben and his cousin Isaac climb into the car. These two are all that are left from Ben's family. His parents, shot by the Gestapo as they were attempting to follow their children and escape Poland for Hungary. Ben's older sister Lola, her fate unknown. Ben's other sister and younger brother marched to the gas chamber upon arrival into Auschwitz. Ben's uncle, not heard from again. This is it. Ben and his cousin Isaac. An hour into the train, loaves of bread are tossed into the train car, into a sea of starving people. Ben and Isaac are seated against the back of the train and do not get any bread.
Those people who were next to the door were grabbing four or five breads. And those people against the wall had nothing. And I and my cousin, we had no bread. We don't know where we're going, for how long we're going to be gone. I had to get a bread. So I started to climb over the sitting inmates' heads to get to the door to see if I can wrestle out the bread from one of the men who had several breads. And as I'm climbing on the inmates, one of them had a pocket knife and he stabs me. Now I feel the stab in my throat. In my mouth, there's blood filling up. And I couldn't stop. I had to go get the bread. So I keep climbing. I climb and I see this man had five breads. So I pull one bread away from him. He punches me. I put the bread in my back pocket and I climb back to my cousin. My cousin says, "Ben, what's happening? You're bleeding." I put my finger here and went right through the tongue. How I survived. People, 1 week, 2 weeks, people were dying. We stop and go, stop and go, and stop and go. And people all around me were dying.
Ben rationed his bread eating, allowing himself and his cousin just a scrap of bread every day. That one loaf of bread lasted 2 weeks between two people who were quite literally starving to death. The train ride, however, was 3 weeks long. So Ben and his cousin were trapped in a train car, no food, watching the other prisoners in the car die around them, one by one.
After 3 weeks, they finally arrived at a place called Dachau. They opened up the door. Almost everybody, and practically everybody was dead. And they say, whoever can walk out over the tracks and into the camp of Dachau.
The infamous death train consisted of nearly 40 cattle cars packed with prisoners transported to the Dachau death camp in the last days of the war. The trip was supposed to last 3 days, but the odyssey ended up being 3 weeks. 3,000 prisoners walked on that train. Only 18 walked off. Ben and his cousin were two of the 18. Today, Ben is the only living survivor of the death train.
And now we're coming inside and we see a mountain full of dead bodies. Next to the crematorium, I guess the Nazis ran out of coal, so they couldn't burn the bodies. There was a mountain there full of bodies.
The Dachau prison guards packed the new arrivals into the already overcrowded barracks, cramming 1,600 men into buildings that were designed for 250. Starvation and disease tore through the camp, claiming the lives of thousands of prisoners just days before liberation. The Nazis tried to cremate as many of these bodies as they could before abandoning Dachau, but there were too many. Ben and his cousin were directed to a barracks. They laid on the floor, too weak to move. There were no rations. 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. Dachau was located in the heart of Germany, near Munich. The Dachau concentration camp was the oldest in the vast network of Nazi death camps and was the last to be freed on April 29th, 1945.
And after the third day, finally we hear, "Befreiung, Befreiung, liberation, Americans, Americans." We heard that. I said to my cousin, "Let's go out and see what happened." So holding each other, we go out and we see that the inmates are crawling on their hands and feet and kissing the boots from the GIs. They looked like gods to us.
When the American soldiers of the 45th Thunderbird Division stumbled upon the death train, it was like lighting a fuse that couldn't be snuffed out. The men of the 45th had been in combat for almost 500 days, and they thought they had seen every grisly atrocity that war could throw at them. But then there was this train, filled with innocent bodies, their eyes and mouths open as if crying out for mercy. The first thing the liberators encountered upon entering Dachau was the train, littered with bodies. Many of the American soldiers broke down in sobs. Others seethed with red-hot rage. The few remaining German soldiers who were surrendering on sight were gunned down by the American soldiers who were traumatized at the scene. Among the many traumatic experiences that awaited the liberators at Dachau was encountering the surviving prisoners, who numbered about 32,000. Walking skeletons is the only way to describe their condition. The hollow-eyed, brutalized, barely breathing, diseased, walking skeletons, the sight of which made the sobbing liberators throw up with revulsion and horror. That was Ben and his cousin Isaac. Ridden with typhus and lice, the overwhelmed prisoners grabbed at their liberators' uniforms. They were in disbelief that their torturous ordeal could be over. Some men died as they were crawling through the dirt to welcome the Americans. U.S. Colonel Ralph Hauenstein was one of the liberators of Dachau. 66 years after the end of the war, he spoke of this haunting memory shortly before he died at the age of 103.
Being the early arrival into the concentration camp in Dachau is something that seems to stay with me more than most anything else. But somehow this was so so different in life to see that what man can do to his fellow man and what a nation can do to its own people is something that is so great and so profound in memory that it probably is the most vivid event that I do remember out of all of the various things that I've been a part of. The thing about it was there were bodies by the hundreds and hundreds stored would lie on them, and they would take these bodies and put them on the slab, and then they take kind of a vice and put it in their mouths to work it back and forth to get the gold teeth out of them. And then once they got that, they would throw them in the furnace, you know. And I pulled one boy, I remember, a boy, I don't know, young. I think he was a little Polish Jewish guy, and we pulled him out one time, just in time, because he had that in there. He was, they were testing him. He was one of the groups, they were testing the Luftwaffe. Had been testing individuals to see how long they could live in water at certain temperatures before they died. But they were sure glad to see us get out of there. Yeah.
Unprepared and unaware of how to care for people in such advanced stages of starvation, the soldiers pulled out their C rations and Hershey bars and gave everything over to the skeletal prisoners, who gorged themselves on the food. Tragically, their digestive system simply couldn't handle solid food.
Two GIs walked up to us. They opened up a can of Spam, and it smelled so good, they handed it to us, and we made a mistake. We ate some of it. Both of us came down with dysentery. That night, my cousin dies in my arms. And I'm talking to him. I can't believe he's dead. I'm talking to him. And while I'm talking to him, somebody heard that. They walked up and they came back and they took my cousin away. And while I'm following, my knees gave out from under me and I fell down. Towards the evening, a man walks up to me, beautifully dressed with a nice suit. And he introduces himself. He is a Jesuit priest. And he came with a bunch of nuns and doctors from Paris. And they're opening up a field hospital in the yard of Dachau. And he's going to take me to the field hospital. On the way, he tells me something that I never forgot. He says, Benek, you Jewish people went through such terrible things. All the punishments that you received for one sin, that you were born to Jewish parents, how terrible it is. He says, however, Benek, don't you ever abandon your noble religion.
To hear that sentiment from someone who was not Jewish in 1945's Europe was very rare indeed. Ben was taken to the makeshift infirmary. He was placed on a cot with a real blanket, and he had an IV placed in his arm. Ben passed out. Word of what happened at places like Dachau and Buchenwald spread quickly through the Allied forces. Adolf Hitler committed suicide one day after Dachau was liberated. At that point, the German defeat was all but assured. Ben was just a boy, an ordinary boy. He survived two ghettos. Through cunning and courage and luck, he evaded capture from the Nazis for almost 5 years. Once captured, he survived four concentration camps, death marches, and the death train. All the family that he knew was lost to him. He was penniless and uneducated, and he was sick, so sick. He was free, but for what? What kind of a life would be ahead for Ben Lesser? We answer that question in episode 3. I'm Leslie Gold. Thank you for listening to A Life's Story.